Accession number 14983, Albert Shippen, reel 14.
Mr. Shippen, reel 14. When did you leave Salonika?
We left Salonika, I would think it would be the beginning of 1948. And once again, the judgment of the War Office, as it was known in those days, leaves much to be desired. You can just imagine a battalion of the Durham Light Infantry being out in Greece, very demoralised now, posting us back to the United Kingdom, to the city of Bath. Oh, what a failure. We went to a camp called Monkton Farley, which was a huge underground ammunition depot just outside Bath, near a place called Bradford-on-Avon. There was the Pioneer Corps were there, and we had very little good accommodation while we were stationed there. And after being out in the Middle East and coming back in rags and tatters, it was most demoralising. The city of Bath refused under any circumstances to accept us in any shape or form. The police, the city of Bath police, in those days were chaps over 6 foot, had more medals on than Montgomery, and just hated our guts from square one. Socially, were outcasts. They didn't want to know us in any shape or form. We had a very, very bad liaison with the city police and also with the inhabitants.
How did it show itself?
Well, we used to go into town, and pay night was Thursday night. And as we alighted from any of the modes of transport we could get onto, the police would pass and the remark was, you know, you boys behave yourselves tonight or you'll end up in the cooler. And all such remarks as that. We used to go into a bar and or some place like that. And you would find the atmosphere just died around you. I mean, if you went into a decent hotel, I mean, you've got to remember that we had very little clothing, and I think we weren't what you would call chocolate box soldiers, smart and tidy or anything like that. We only came home with what we'd got. And you know, the city of Bath, obviously, in those days, I would think was quite upper crust, to put it bluntly. And, of course, being Durham Light Infantry as well, and the majority of us that was in the Durham Light, we did come from Durham in those days. And you could just imagine the joy saying, "Oh, Mara, I'm going to hammer over here, you know, and where's Lugan and Indian?" All such remarks as that, you know, bloody foreign troops are back here again. We didn't get a very good social life at all down there. And then, of course, one of the most devastating things to happen to us, again, we're just starting to pull the battalion down, working very, very hard. And, of course, coming into Southern Command, we had to comply with Southern Command orders. And there were all different things, how to do this and how to do that, and this order had to be complied with and that, which we didn't do when we were in Salonika, and this kind of thing. We didn't have all this administration and that to contend with and that. And then someone, again, they must be brilliant in this, the war office at the time, decided to send the guards out past Egypt to Malaya. And they selected the KSLI to take over the public duties in London from the guards. And once again, the young cry went out to the Light Division, as we were then known as, Light Infantry Brigade, stealing 50% of my buglers and 50% of the battalion to do guards at the tower and so forth and that. And at the same time, we were supposedly being prepared for the 1st and 2nd Battalion to amalgamate. And we were coming back up into Durham, to Bransford, to have this parade sorted out. The second Battalion people were very thin on the ground because they'd been decimated by fueling up other units in the Far East and that. And we were down to a very small number of people and still trying to collect our people in on ERE jobs. And in fact, two of the sergeants that were on the colour party for the 1st Battalion were actually instructors at Sandhurst, but they had to come across on temporary loan to us to get enough people to do the colour guard. And of course the band was at Bransford at the time, and there was no accommodation for them down in Moncton Farley, and of course I kept having to shoot up to Bransford to talk to the bandmaster about what marches and that we're going to play. And of course a good 50% of the buglers had never played combined marches in their lives. They played the calls and everything and that. And a lot of them were just duration of emergency men waiting for their debobbing number to come up to go out at all. So rather boxed in all the way around. In the end, after many trials and tribulations and arguments with the KSLI, I did manage to retrieve some of my buglers back, which was a bit of a blessing in disguise. But it was very, very hard work trying to fit all these things in on top of the other duties and that were we started to give, pulling the battalion together alone was a monumental job. And then of course the general we were talking about, Flanagan, who'd been our quartermaster and everything like that, was a junior quartermaster to another quartermaster who'd been posted in above him. Flanagan went off to some sports centre or somewhere in the Southern Command, and a chap called Bertie Newman took over. Now he'd come up through the orderly room, and not an RSM, and he was the opposite to Flanagan. Flanagan more or less ruled the roost. He was an ex-RSM and knew everybody and knew every regulation there was going. But Bertie Newman was a very quiet, nice chap to get along with, and a hail fellow well met kind of business. So that changed, because when Flanagan was there, I remember one day we were practicing with the colours in Moncton Farley, the Queen's colour and that takes precedence over everybody, and everybody salutes them and that. And there was this squad of the Pioneer Corps who worked very hard at this ammunition dump, this underground ammunition dump and that. And of course, the battalion was parading past, you see, and he had the buglers and that. And so they all dashed out the canteen to see what was happening. and this kind of thing. And of course, the colour party went past, nobody brought anybody to attention, nobody saluted. So this Flanagan put them all in the clink, put them all in our guard room for failing to carry out compliments to the colours. Of course, they didn't even know what the colours were. But those are the kind of things that we were encountering on down there. And we came to Bransford.
Where were your recruits coming from for the battalion? Was this National Service people coming
yes,
in?
Yes, yes. In fact, if I can hasten to say, I think that the National Service was one of the best things that ever happened to the British Army. And without them, we could not have survived. Our intake and that, we had to have people, because more administration was coming into the army in those days, and the pay corps and all this kind of thing, and food was being revised and all this kind of thing. More intelligent people were required, and that, and the regulars just didn't have that ability to be able to do these things. If you went round the battalion, and that, as we got our support weapons in, you would find that I would say, without any fear of contradiction, 75% to 80% of those men in the specialist platoons, and in the orderly rooms and clerks and signal platoons and that, were all National Servicemen.
And they were good quality people.
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, I think one of the biggest disgraces was the majority of National Servicemen, very few of them attained the rank of sergeant. They could do, but more of them should have been permitted to be made sergeants, and that, because without them, the British Army would have been nothing. They could have... We just didn't have the people that was in there at that time with the education qualification. And a lot of these chaps that were being posted into us in this kind of thing were tradesmen, and that being deferred and being at college and this kind of thing. And those were the people that came. And as far as I was concerned, they give a different dimension to the army. They weren't what I call army barmy, like a lot of regulars were, like that bloke Flanagan was. They give you a different outlook on things, and they didn't demoralise you in any way, and they made you think a little bit more. Instead of taking everything as gospel, you and they made life a bit more interesting. And I used to enjoy the conversations we had with the education sergeants who were attached to us, who were not 99% National Servicemen, but they were in the education corps and used to take us on school and map reading and so forth and that. But I think they did a very good job, and I would never agree to you either regulars, you know, the National Servicemen, blah, blah, blah. And I used to have many arguments with different people. I was on a guards drill course, and we had to get up and give these lecturettes and this kind of thing. So I chose to give this lecturette at this guards drill course on what a good job the National Servicemen were doing in infantry battalions. And there was a battery sergeant major there from the Royal Artillery in the same squad as I was. And he said, you know, talked a load of rubbish and all this kind of thing, you know. We had quite a heated debate about this, but I always admired the National Servicemen, and I think they did a tremendous job, and I would never change my mind about that at all.
So then you went to Bransford. Is this you personally or the battalion moving?
Oh, we had to come up to Bransford to do the...
What date was this?
Well, this would be, I would think about the autumn of 48 or something like that, where we were amalgamating the two battalions, which, as I say, was a token force from the 2nd Battalion. And a fair sprinkling of 1st Battalion, but mostly chaps had been drafted in, and this kind of thing. So we got our amalgamation done, and the cadre of the 2nd Battalion was formed.
And this, the highlight of this was the final parade?
Yes.
How was that organised? How was that done?
Well, it was done at Bransford Castle, on the green outside Bransford Castle. But where it was done, the two colour parties, obviously the guards marched on separately, under the separate commands of the 1st and 2nd Battalion, and this kind of thing, with the token escorts, and this kind of thing. And then, at the point of time, the escort companies with the colours then trooped through the escort companies and this kind of thing. And then when they came out, the two the colour parties joined up together with the two escort companies, and they then advanced in review order as the 1st and 2nd Battalion for the last time. And then the 2nd Battalion colour party with its escort then marched off the parade ground altogether. Then the escort joined up with the colour party, then joined up with the parade. And then that was signified that that was then the 1st Battalion, and the 2nd Battalion colours had gone and were in suspended animation.
Who was this in front of?
Oh, well, all the families and everything and that was there. It was the Brigadier Churchill, and that was there, General Airy, those majority of the ex-commanding officers, all of the dignitaries, the mayors and that of the county, and the towns and boroughs and that was there. Parachute Regiment, which used to be the 9th Battalion, they were there. They were the 17th Parachute Battalion. Cadet Forces, and the ATS, and that, Territorial Battalions. Everyone connected with the regiment were there. Cadets from the Bourse School, from Durham School, and that, just everybody that was there, because it was an end of an era of a regiment being cut down to from two regular battalions to one.
Who took the salute?
I think it was Brigadier Jackie Churchill at the time, who was colonel of the regiment at that particular time.
So there must have been some feeling of sadness in it, that a battalion was going.
Well, I think one of the sad things about it was that the pre-war soldiers, the 1st Battalion, the 2nd Battalion had started in India, then it came home to Blackdown in the south of England, and the 1st Battalion went out to China, and those that still had the service to do overseas from the 2nd Battalion joined the 1st Battalion, and the 2nd Battalion came home, then went into France, and then came in back into the United Kingdom, then went out to Burma, and was out there till the amalgamation. So the battalions never joined up together, because the 1st Battalion went out to China, then into the Sudan, and into the Middle East, and then fought in Wavell's 30,000 in the Middle East and everything like that, then went to Malta, and then were in Kos and Leos, then formed up again in Mima, and then went into Italy, and then after Italy into Greece, and then came home. So you can see that the two battalions never even served together, and there was very little cross postings because of the situation. And a lot of the regular soldiers that had served pre-war obviously decided to go out, and very few had come back into the army. And what had, you see, the Territorial Army had then been amalgamated again, and a lot of them had been serving as PSIs and that with the territorial army. So I suppose if you look at it in that light, it was a sad day, but I don't think it affected a lot of people personally because there wasn't the connection there. I suppose the second battalion felt it more than what the first did, because we'd survived going into suspended animation, and we had been together for some considerable period of time, and that where the second battalion had been, once it had been going into suspended animation, had been decimated and people had sent all over the place, and what was left of the second battalion had come to the first battalion, so we'd got to know them kind of people, but they were first battalion people by the time the parade had come.
After the parade, what happened then?
Oh, well, the usual presentation to the different people and this kind of thing. And, of course, there was a sergeant's ball at the night time with prominent guests and that. There was in the cookhouse and all this kind of thing. Beer was given out to the men and all this kind of thing. The usual jolly and that went on. Under those circumstances, I think it was 2 days later, we're all banged off back down to Monkton Farley.
Basically, what you were doing there, you say you were pulling the battalion together. Was it very much a regimental situation where it was just basic training and so forth that was going on?
Yes, I think it was very, very, as I say, it seemed as though Sunderland Command, we had to go to all these demonstrations and this kind of thing in Sunderland Command, we had to take up their procedure of administrations and what have you and all this kind of thing. We had to get the education qualifications which were coming in and all this kind of stuff that together. And then they expected you to do all the other things on top of that. But the battalion was getting pulled together because we were going off to the BOR. And as I say, we had our people up with the KSLI and we had to pull them back. And they'd been learnt drill, they'd been drilled 8 hours a day on the square by these guards, RSMs and this kind of thing. And of course our drill, the light infantry drill and their drill was entirely different. They wanted them to do this and that and the other. And of course we'd had no parades or anything on for a considerable time. And we didn't know how to do a form. And as they used to do, the guards, and wanted this doing and that doing. And I think it was a real bag of worms at the time, and I think somebody must have realised they were getting nowhere fast in Monkton Farley, because we're in amongst a working environment with the Pioneer Corps and this ammunition place, which I believe also served the Navy as well, and the RAF. It was quite a considerable dump underground. I think it's still there at the moment, functioning.
Were new weapons coming into you now?
No.
You're still on Lee Enfields?
Yes, there's nothing like that coming into us at the moment, no.
No changes?
No, very little changes. Very little changes at all. But no. New Year's Day, 1949, we set off for Dortmund in the Ruhr.
How did you look upon this prospect?
Well, I think when we arrived, we stood there with our mouths open. We'd never had such palatial accommodation for years and years. The sergeant's mess, the mess room, was unbelievable. The men's accommodation, four in a room. waitresses, gardeners. Was unbelievable. The furniture and that in the men's billets and all this kind of thing, and we just couldn't believe our luck. We thought we'd been given the long straw for the change.
What date did you arrive there?
New Year's Day, 1949.
And was this accommodation ex-German army barracks?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, oh, it was a huge barracks. We had the 10th Anti-Tank 10th Anti-Tank Regiment on our left, and we had the 40th Field on our right. So you can just imagine there's two artillery units, which are very considerable, and the 40th Field was a huge unit, and we were in between the two units. We had very good accommodation and a very good square and a nice canteen. Officers' mess was very palatial. The sergeant's mess was palatial. Accommodation for the men was good. The officers were good. Administration officers. The guard room was first class. We had the central supply depot at the top of us, run by the RASC, which is quite good, because we made very good friends with the majority of the staff there. And Naffy Bulk Supply was there as well, which we looked after very well as well, on top of that. And then we had, for the first time, we had married families, and they had very good accommodation. Just across the road, we had what they called Camp 7, which had a huge naffy in, but put on variety shows and everything, and a huge cinema, and plenty of sports, rugby, football, cricket, tennis, and so forth and that. And would you believe it or not, 50 Hercules cycles, which we could go and draw and go out on cycle rides with.
How did you look forward to going to Germany when it was announced?
Well, I think when we realised and we were given our brief and what was happening, I thought that, somebody at last had smiled on us. Because the band was joining us from Bransford, which we never had with us before. We had a new commanding officer then. There was two brothers, F.H. Simpson and Y.B.I. Simpson, and they were changing over at the time. Unfortunately, Colonel Kirby, and you can appreciate this, that after he'd brought us home from Greece and this kind of thing, it was getting on a bit in life, and had been a prisoner of war for some considerable time, had to go on a course to see what his capabilities were to command a battalion, which, remember, was going into BOR and was going to play a very prominent part in anything that happened in the Cold War time, the BOR, the British Army of the Rhine, and so forth. But unfortunately, didn't come out with flying colours in his course, and he lost his command of the battalion and was put into retirement. And then we got R.B.Y. Simpson, who'd had a very distinguished war record, but unfortunately took ill on numerous occasions. And we had a second in command called Major Fannin Evans, who took command of the battalion on numerous of occasions. And then we got the dreaded Colonel Michael Anmer, an Air Command officer, who had also a brilliant war record and was a brilliant man in his own right, I can assure you.